Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Andy's back. Yes, it's our roving reporter, the man with the inside scoop on everything that's triathlon. It's Mr. Tim Hemming. Welcome back, Tim.
Hello, Simon. Thanks for having me back on the show.
It's a pleasure, Tim. We always get lots of downloads for your podcasts that you appear on, so that's all good. So what have you been up to?
Yeah, I get the whole extended family downloading it.
That's right, yeah. Who knew you had so many members of your extended family? But in all seriousness, what have you been up to recently?
Not a massive amount. I played tried to play a charity football match. It was 24 hours, and I ended up giving myself a horrible injury, completely innocuous, just changed direction, and ripped up all through my adductors and up into my lower abdomen area. I actually felt it go all the way back through to my lumbar spine. It's horrible. And it all went, and everything turned black, my friend.
I've seen the photograph, actually. You did a blog post for, just remind me who it was for.
I did a blog post for Sports Nutrition Brand 33 Shake. Just on the perils of being probably running too much and being sat either in the saddle or being sat behind the computer too much and not really having a lot of flexibility in the core area. Just getting a bit old in there, yeah.
Well, we
put a horrified photo on there.
Well, it did look pretty painful. We'll put a link in the show notes to that, just in case anyone wants to see what happens when you go from endurance sports in a straight line to playing five-a-side football for a bit of a laugh.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Oh, well, you wrote it, mate. This last weekend, I just rode an event called The Struggle on the Yorkshire Moors, and by golly, it was a struggle. The hills aren't particularly long, but they are very, very steep. And I'm talking the last three hills had sections at 33%. And it was very, very hot and humid. Fortunately, the sun was disappeared behind some clouds. But I managed to get through that. It was a long day of riding with some friends, so that was all good. And that came on the back of a 9-day trip with 7 days of riding in the Alps. So we rode all the way from Rauris in the eastern part of Austria.
A hell of a ride.
That was a hell of a ride, yeah, in 7 days. In the eastern part of Austria, near Zell am See, and we rode all the way across through Austria, Switzerland, into France, finishing near Morzin in a place called Vachai, which is just a little further away from Lake Geneva there. So brilliant ride, 550 miles, 15,000 meters of climbing. Absolutely fabulous weather, spectacular part of the world. Which brings me right very, very smoothly into your first subject that you raised, and it is Ironman Austria, one of my favorite races ever. This one, what a beautiful part of the world. But we've got some sort of not so good stuff to chat about with regard to this race, I think.
Yeah, I don't think from the pro perspective, I don't think this is going to go down in the annals as one to, well, maybe infamously, but certainly not one to remember for many positive reasons.
Okay. Tell me a bit more then.
First off, half the podium, that's the six athletes, obviously three men, three women, and some doping associations. And coming around the same time as we had the Chris Froome debacle over the Tour de France and whether he was going to be racing with salbutamol, and endurance sport was already being dragged through the mire in the press. In some ways, this goes very unnoticed. You've got Michael Weiss, who's been banned in 2011, blood taken for Richmond in 2005, as long ago as that. He didn't contest the case. Ivan Tutakin had an issue with meldonium, which is for people might remember was the Maria Sharapova drug that people were taking for years, and then it got banned at the start of 2016. So question marks over him around that. And then Lisa Hutheiler, who is a perennial non-favourite in triathlon.
Her name, whenever there's bad news, her name's
in the park.
Yeah, whenever there's some bad news, she seems to pop up.
She came second in the women's race, just ahead of Britain's Emma Pallant. But there's an EPO pass with her, but then there's also a wild scattergun allegation of many offences from drafting on her from a boyfriend all through a course. I think that was Ironman Florida, just sideswiping in ITU racing and all sorts. So, she's a sort of persona non grata in many ways, but she still keeps popping up on the podium, so it's hard to ignore.
Well, she must have she must have a thick skin though, because every time I read about a race in which she's in, there's something bad associated with her. But she keeps turning up, and she can't be that popular amongst the girls that she races with. But it doesn't seem to bother her too much.
A lot of people that get busted for doping, or seemingly a lot of people get busted for doping, they don't just leave sport; they return to it after they've served their ban. So, whether it's because they have just a completely different mentality to it in the first place, which could be the case, or perhaps they just have nothing else in their life to go to. It is their career and they know nothing else. So therefore, they see it as their only real option to make some money. So if that is the case, then you develop a siege mentality and say it's me against the world. It's hard to know, really, without getting inside someone's head. And oftentimes, I mean, on the odd occasion when Lisa Hurtado, for example, has been interviewed, it's really difficult. You feel like you need to read between the lines to make any truth out of it.
So what was the, apart from the sort of half of the podium, having a sort of shadowy past, what was the issue?
That wasn't the biggest talking point at all. The biggest talking point was a statement that British racer Susie Cheetham released, who came fourth. And she was some distance off the pace, to be honest. She came fourth. She was distanced on the bike, and there Susie's a good runner, but couldn't make it back. I think she was 14 minutes down, either off the bike or in the finish. However, the point being that she filed a protest with photographic and video evidence against one of the leading three women, Hurtado being one, Pallant being another, and then the winner, I think it was German Hufer, so I don't have the exact winner information in front of me. Anyway, point being that the appeal got taken. Ironman looked at the appeal and they actually chose to act, but what they did was they advanced all the women from fourth place and down 5 minutes up.
Right.
Which was an odd one, really. So it wasn't any punishment for the one of the leading three women who was not named, but it was actually advancing everyone else by 5 minutes. The net effect of all this in terms of race result was absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So it's all quite a kerfuffle, and it raises a bunch of other questions as well, such as, can anyone just submit video or photographic evidence and have retrospective action taken against athletes on the course? Is that the right thing to do? Susie was incredibly polite, I would suggest, with her statement and professional with it. Yet again, she said, I appreciate the genuine concern from race officials, organisers and Iron Management. However, when she posted that statement on social media, the reality was that there'd been no change to the result, and most people realised that.
So it looks, I'm looking at her statement here, and it said that she was complaining about girls getting an unfair advantage due to inadequate moto discipline. So I'm not sure if you use your phrase reading between the lines, whether that's a subtle way of saying the motorbike was too close and the girls were taking advantage of it. And so
explain that slightly better.
So giving everybody a 5 minute advance is basically saying, well, we understand that these girls got a benefit and you didn't. So what we'll do is give you an extra 5 minutes rather than disciplining them. But this seems to be a theme that's running through quite a few events, doesn't it? Because I know there was a lot of talk after Tim Don's time in Brazil last year that he gained a big advantage from the motos there, the TV cameras and the press bikes. And I think in a couple of other races as well, some of the leaders have been accused of taking advantage of that. Now, Ironman are saying, well, there's nothing wrong there, and they've recognised that these times are the fastest in the world, but it doesn't seem to sit very well with the rest of the field.
No, and it does make a bit of a mockery of it in terms of pure racing, right? I mean, to say that In this case with Armanostra, I think the motor pacing at the front was part of the problem, and they were sat too close behind the vehicles, lead vehicles. And I also think there were some issues with drafting as well. And I should have explained that a bit more at the top. However, I'm not sure you can entirely, you can't entirely blame, for example, Pindon in Brazil when he set the Ironman world record just because the motorbike wouldn't go up the road. I mean, yeah, of course, there's an argument to be said that he should be waving it away and telling him to get lost, but he's concentrating on his racing as well. It's really that down to proper race organisation, being, you know, and the drafting sound having putting the road marshals on the course and making sure that they know what they're doing as well.
Yes.
So it all comes back to the organisers ultimately.
And I mean, they do seem to take that a bit more seriously in Hawaii when it's the World Championships. Although, if you go right back to the time when Dave Scott and Mark Allen were racing, there was arguments going back there about the big van that had the NBC cameras in it being too close and that people would get a benefit of riding behind that. You know, even 30 metres behind, you can feel the draft benefits. So it's not a new argument either.
No, it's a long-standing problem. And in terms of, let's take this example here with Susie. So the response she had is very polite from them. You know, they say they're taking her concerns seriously. But effectively, it comes from a faceless organization, right? Nobody really fully puts out of and takes responsibility. Nothing actually has, as we've seen in the past, nothing tends to change. And it's not always just Ironman. I was out in Dubai for the inaugural Challenge Dubai, as it was then. And there was a course cutting by the men at the front of that race. And they got some arbitrary time penalties that didn't actually change the podium at all and left the result as it stood across the finish line. And it was almost like a saving face kind of gesture. And it feels that nothing is going to change because it's not a big enough priority. So what are the priorities? Well, the priorities are getting, obviously, you know, people to race, to pay, to race and get as many people on the course. And try and keep costs down in terms of officiating. And then if something like you have a big media wagon at the front of the race, or someone like Ironman who wants to publicize a race in Hawaii and put it out on NBC, and that for them is more important probably than making sure that media wagon stays enough distance up the road. So it all comes down to fundamental priorities. And as a private company, as we've talked about in the past, that's always going to be making money.
Well, you could extend this discussion out to the clear debacle that happened at Ironman Texas with just huge packs of riders, you know, from which were visible on TV, on cameras that they're actually installed as part of the road safety network, aren't they? Just those CCTV things there. Other races where clearly there are so many riders that it wouldn't be possible for all of those people that we know that come out during that busy portion of the swim exit to actually fit onto the road and leave an appropriate gap to avoid drafting. But Ironman again seem unwilling to do anything about this. And I guess, you know, while that's happening and they've got big numbers, then it's going to continue, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, you got to look at their priorities and how many of those people that are racing are in it to compete and how many in it to complete. And until the numbers that are actually competing or the proportion gets higher, then not enough people are really going to care. So if we wind it back to Ironman Austria and Susie's statement about where things, you know, she sees things went wrong. Well, how many people really care about that? And until enough do, then no changes are going to be made.
No, I guess that's true of the front end. I mean, most people won't even see those athletes on race day. But I do wonder how many age groupers are really bothered about drafting. A lot of people talk about drafting as being something they don't like, but then you see lots of people riding in groups. So I wonder if what they say is compatible with what they're actually doing.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. We need to do more testing to find out on that one.
Okay, well, let's just move over the border from Austria then onto Ironman Germany, which was the big European race, big European long distance race of last weekend and probably the summer so far. So, Frodeno versus Lang. I'm not sure if it was a rematch because he sort of, with his bad back in Konri, threw in the towel a bit, didn't he, Frodeno in Hawaii? But he seems to have come back with a vengeance recently.
I think he had the bit between his teeth for this one. It was a terrific race, really, both the men's and the women's race. It was plenty of talking points and quite a spectacle. Fredino, who's the two-time Ironman world champion, he took it out, and he looked imperious. But I think he led the – he was up at the front with a bike for a lot, and he had the two Patricks, Lang and Nielsen, kind of tucked in behind him. And listening to some of his comments at the end of the race, and he eventually ran away from them, but listening to some of his comments, he was pretty desperate for either them to do some work on the bike or to try and shake them off. So whether there was not too much love lost there and sort of put the order back right after, obviously, he flunked, as you said, in Hawaii.
Well, that's an interesting point there, isn't it? He was desperate for them to come and do some work on the bike, and yet we talk about this as a non-drafting sport, so... Those people who are uncertain about how Ironman works versus WTS will be interested to know why somebody would want others to come and do the work on the front.
Yeah, and effectively that's because if they ride, even if at legal distance, they still believe that there's a good benefit to be gained, even if you're 12 meters back. And there's probably a psychological benefit as well to be able to be gained in terms of just being able to track somebody on the course. Interestingly, they actually spiked 185 kilometers. So for all of the stick that Ironman has got recently for having short courses, this one was a long bike course. So the times were a little bit slower than they have been in some of the previous years. Fredino still went just about 8 hours, but again, they biked a little longer, which probably didn't play into the hands of Langer and Nielsen, who would probably put their hands up to be two of the quickest runners in the sport.
Well, and the thing that's interesting to me is that I think Fredino was 7 or 8 minutes faster than Patrick Langer on the run, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he was domineering, right? It was a perfect performance, and it looks like he's really back to his best. And in terms of looking ahead towards Hawaii this year, it looks like it could be a fantastic race with those three that we've talked about there, but also add to that Javier Gomez and Lionel Sanders into the mix, and it could be one of the best ever.
It could be. One ought to make sure one got on a plane out there in October, Tim.
Yeah, it'd be great, right?
Yeah, we can have coffee again at Lava Java.
Superb. We should talk about the women's race there, though, as well.
Well, yes.
Domination by Daniela Reif, who must be staking her claim to be one of, if not the best, long distance. She's in Chrissy Wellington territory in terms of some of her performances now.
Yeah, what was the time there? 8:38? I think.
Yeah, and so we've already mentioned it was a long bike. Obviously a long bike course. So they were biking 185 kilometers. I think the rest of the course, the rest of the bike, the swim and the run, I think were pretty accurate. But she finished seventh overall. And just getting the results up in front of me now in terms of how far ahead of the second pro woman she was. And if the Ironman tracker had worked a little faster, that would be terrific, but
I'm looking for the results.
Great podcasting.
I'm looking for the results as well. We should have had. Yeah, well, here we go. 8:38:905.
And she was over 26 minutes ahead of Sarah True. And Sarah True ran a 2:54 marathon on debut. So yeah, lots of terrific performances from Frankfurt.
Well, we've got a couple of Olympians in there, haven't we? Because we've got Sarah True, Annie Haug as well, went to the Olympics. She was fourth, so her step up to the longer distance. So she's been doing quite well at 70.3 events, but her step up to the longer distance looks to be going okay. Although compared to Daniela Reif, she's still got 40 odd minutes to make up, so needs a bit of help somewhere there.
Yeah, it's a long way down the road. I mean, Anne Haug always looked like she'd potential to do well at long distance, and because she's quite small, she could potentially do quite well in Hawaii as well. She'd get rid of that bit of heat quite easy. But she wasn't the thing that let her down at ITU racing. And if we go back about 6 years, she was really challenging and at the top and potential for Olympic medal territory. But was her swim and whether she'd make the second pack. So stepping up to long course, as we know, the swim becomes less important, and her biking and her running's really, and particularly her running, has really not been questioned.
Yeah, except that when you talk about Kona, it's a non-wetsuit swim. So, and we know there that if you start off the bike with a deficit in Hawaii, you're going to have to really work hard just to get back on an even keel before you take into consideration the run. So,
absolutely. And look, I mean, it's not to say that the swim is unimportant, but if you compare it to an ITU race, where if you don't make the front pack, it's race over. At least in Hawaii, you've got 112 miles to do something about it on the bike.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, well, let's move on then. So we're talking about WTS racing. So we've got the European Championships coming up very soon in Glasgow. So what have you got to tell us about that there, Tim, in terms of what you know?
Yeah, the European Champs is, although we've had some terrific winners over the years, you know, from the women's side breaking back to kind of Sarah Springman and Sarah Coop, right up to Jess Learmonth, who won it last year. And on the men's side, Alistair Brownie's a triple champion. The European Championships is in some way seen as a bit of a second tier event, or traditionally has been. Well, they've tried to ramp it up, and it's become a multi-sport festival for this year, and it's going to be televised as well. From the 2nd to the 12th of August, there's 12 sports over those days. It's split between Glasgow and Germany, because Germany are hosting the athletics. There's also swimming, obviously triathlon as well. And we've got a men's race, we've got a women's race, and we've got a mixed relay, and the venue is Strathclyde Park, so the same as for the 2014 Commonwealth Games.
Mm. So who have we got racing in the men's then? Or who's on the start list?
In terms of the squad, we've got the two Scots, Mark Austin and Grant Sheldon. Mark Austin, he took bronze, I think, didn't he, at the Commonwealth Games, which was a breakthrough performance for him.
Yes.
Gold Coast a couple of months back. And Grant Sheldon, who's come up with him through the ranks and has been a world under 23 medalist in the past. And then we do have Alistair Brownlee on the start list, who's now the old man of the old man of the squad at 30 years old. Alistair's obviously had a few injuries to put up with this year, didn't make the Leeds WTS race, which was a shame. Do you know what shape he's in?
I think he's swimming pretty well. He never seems to, having a running injury never seems to stop him swimming. I was watching the Offaly City Centre cycling, and Mr. A. Brownlee was on the start list along with Scott Thwaites and Tom Pidcock, so a couple of notable pro tour cycling athletes there, and he was holding his own in that peloton for probably 90% of the race. It got a little fruity in the last few laps as Ed Clancy sat on the front trying to reel Tom Pidcock in, and Alistair was at the back of that bunch just trying to hold on in the group. But, you know, he's racing with the Cat 1 and pro cyclists there. And so when you're a triathlete and you can do that, says something about your cycling. So he's certainly going to make them work on the bike. Whether he's fit enough to with his running, I don't know. I've not seen him running recently.
It would be great if he did start that race. It'd be great to, because he always throws another element, even in the Commonwealth Games, where obviously he was struggling on the run. Was out of contention as soon as they came out of T2, but he put a lot into the swim and the bike and added a lot for spectators with that. And I guess the one thing is that the Strathclyde Park course is a genuine triathlon course, so there's an opportunity to get away on the bike, which you couldn't really do in the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast because it was that flat and fast. So if he has the opportunity to make the break in that field, then, you know, maybe his running doesn't need to be of top notch, or doesn't have to be in supreme run form to actually take a medal. We shall see. But let's hope he's on the start line.
Who else have we got racing from other nations there then? Have we any of the notable Spaniards racing?
So I haven't checked the rest of the field on that one. So all I've got is the British lineup for Glasgow.
What about the ladies then?
Yeah, and on the ladies' side, we've got pretty much the cream, apart from Vicky Holland, we've got the cream of the British triathletes at the moment. We've got Sophie Caldwell, who won, I think, last in, how do you say it, in
Tisivaras,
in Hungary.
Yeah. I think they all call it Tizzy, actually.
They all call it Tizzy to make it easy. Yeah, we've got Jess Learmonth, who's the reigning European champion. India Lee's racing. She was a European champion in 2016. And then we've got non-Stanford who's obviously a former world champion, and Beth Potter, who is transitioning over, coached by your buddy Jack Maitland, formerly of the sort of high performance setup in Leeds. And Beth's obviously an interesting case because she comes from a track background and has some cracking 5K and 10K PBs.
Well, and also she's Scottish, so she'll be racing on home ground. She'll probably get a lot of crowd support.
Very true, very true. So that'd be one to keep your eye open for. And the actual racing for that is on August the 9th, 10th and 11th.
Ah, so about a month's time then, yeah?
Yeah.
Just when we're all starting to look for something else to watch after the Tour de France has finished and the World Cup's over.
Exactly. I mean, certainly the World Cup is dominating the sporting landscape at the moment, isn't it?
It is, but as this is a triathlon podcast, and there'll be some people on here who hate football. We're not going to talk about that, Tim. We've got some other stuff to talk about, and I can't remember what your next subject was. It was, the World Tri Series. So you said that they just announced the dates for next year, and the only thing that we're interested here in Yorkshire is the fact that Leeds got reselected for 2019.
It did, which is terrific, really. And I think the ITU, I know you don't want to talk about the football, but the ITU have been quite smart in terms of there is racing in Hamburg this weekend, but it's pretty much had a break during the World Cup, the Football World Cup has been on. So when that's finished, then perhaps we can turn our minds back to triathlon. In terms of the venues for NEC for 2019, it's kind of the tour's getting quite cemented now in terms of the venues that we go to. So we've got Abu Dhabi's back on there, Bermuda's returning, Yokohama, Leeds, Montreal, Hamburg, Edmonton, and then the grand final is in Lausanne. Lausanne has been off the series for a good number of years, but the rest of them are all, Bermuda's obviously debuted this year, but the rest of them are all starting to cement their places as regular stopovers. And I think that can only be good for the long-term health of the series, so that people realise that a race is happening in a certain city at a certain time of year. It helps to build a little bit of legacy around the event.
Well, I've not been to any of the other venues, but if you think back to when the Tour de France came to Yorkshire, that they still talk about it now in other parts of the world, about the spectacular crowd support that was received there. And every year that the WTS has been in Leeds, the number of people that come out to watch that race and gather in the city centre is phenomenal. And I know that when I talk to some of the Leeds-based athletes, it really spurs them on. And I would imagine that that's the same for some of the athletes coming over here, that they didn't come because it was a Brownlee dominated race, but I think everybody gets a bit of a boost from racing in front of huge crowds.
Yeah, I think the WTS editions of the Leeds races have all been superb, and long may that continue. So that's definitely a highlight on the calendar. Probably the other one is Hamburg, where which is typically a sprint format, and then they have a mixed relay the following day. But that also boasts crowds of hundreds of thousands, so that would be the other one to really watch out for, which gets really big crowd support. And the crowd support makes a massive difference. The World Triathlon Series tends to be focused about being around city centres, and you really need crowds around those centres to make it a good spectacle, and also, like you say, to kind of boost the athletes. Otherwise it can become a damp squib.
Yeah, well, that Lausanne route, though, it'd be interesting to know whether they use the same course that they used back in, was it 2006, when Tim Don won the World Championships there?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, that was a fan that went to watch that race. That was fantastic. Tim, obviously reaching his potential in that particular one. But it's interesting we talk about Tim Don there, because Tim's just started to race again. He's won events. I know he won Costa Rica recently on his return. But Tim came back from a really nasty accident in Hawaii last year, as did, was it Mike Russell, the American guy? But he's not been the only one who's suffered recently. And Matt Russell, sorry, yeah. And it does just bring to the forefront this thing about road safety in triathletes. And I know you'd wanted to talk about the horse on the course issue at Windsor as well.
Yeah, I mean, we can probably take them separately. I think first one on the bike crashes issue, two recent ones, Gian Frodeno, who thankfully was unscathed enough to put in that dominating performance at Frankfurt that we talked about, but he posted a couple of pictures on Instagram showing him bashed up, said he came down at 60 kilometres an hour. And the other one, which is more serious still, was Lorenzo Bozzoni, who's had a remarkable start to the season and was winning races left, right and centre and also backing up week on week on week. He's had a serious road traffic crash, and we don't know what's going to be of that at the moment. I haven't heard any news other than he was taken by ambulance to hospital, but it just shows to underline the dangers out there. And I guess for your point of view as a coach, when you're speaking to your athletes, what do you tell them in terms of how to keep themselves safe?
Well, it's a difficult one. I mean, you know, Frodeno, he's had this bike crash, but he was also quite vocal about, and so was Emma Snowsill, his wife, about a near miss that he had in Australia earlier on in the winter when he went through an intersection with him having the permission with the green light, and a tanker truck went steaming through on a red light and nearly took him out. And I think that shook him up. People like Lionel Sanders and Andy Potts don't ever go outside until they're racing because they're more concerned about staying safe than they are about riding outdoors. Personally, you know, where I live, it's pretty busy around here. I live just down the road from Alistair and Johnny. They would never ride an indoor trainer, but they can head out into the Dales. But it doesn't matter how quiet the roads are. All it takes is one errant motorist who's not paying attention, you know. So if you're going to ride outdoors, I like to be a little bit aggressive when I'm riding, stick out from the curb a bit, wear some bright clothing, make sure I'm seen, make sure motorists see me, try and make eye contact. And that's what I guess I get other people to do. But if you're just building endurance, you can do that by riding your mountain bike on trails. You can ride a cyclocross bike and choose to ride on very quiet roads that perhaps don't have the same surface. If I was going to do my quality training these days, I would definitely do it on an indoor bike where I can have my head down and focus on my effort rather than having to worry about potholes and traffic pulling out of junctions and not really adjusting to my speed. But ultimately, I think it's about being safe. And if I was living down where you are, Tim, in London, I'd definitely be riding my indoor trainer a little bit more than I would be riding out on the roads, I think.
Yeah, you said right at the start that you've been cycling all over Europe in the past few weeks. How do you find attitudes across the continent?
Well, interestingly, I mentioned that I was riding this event on the Yorkshire Moors. The traffic up there is very quiet, although it was probably busier at the weekend because the weather was so nice. But for instance, you come to a main road junction. So we were coming on, crossing a main road from one side road to another. Two guys got across and the traffic came and everybody, the traffic just kept moving. Now it's their right of way and their right to do so. But the contrast with that versus Austria and Switzerland is when motorists saw that there was a group of cyclists, invariably they slow down and stop in the middle of the road and let them all go. And nobody bats an eyelid. All the other motorists are accepting of that. Whereas in England, everybody would be tooting the horn and shouting at the motorists. I think I also found that just motorists tend to wait behind you for a bit longer, give you a little bit more room when they're passing, and you know, they just seem to be more accepting of cyclists and less in a hurry to get everywhere. Having said that, I was reading some stuff about New Zealand where Terenzo was knocked off, and you know, Joanna Lorne was saying the roads are just too small, there isn't any space for cyclists, and the motorists don't want to move out, and eventually there's going to be a collision, and that's unfortunately what happened to Terenzo. So yeah, I do find in the main that motorists in Europe are just a bit more appreciative and forgiving of cyclists. So maybe we should all move to France or Switzerland.
I guess it's partly, maybe it's less country versus country, but partly more the pace of life. So if you're going through a city or to something that's more rural where people feel that they need to get from A to B a hell of a lot quicker, or there's that sort of pent-up aggression, which, you know, I see a lot in London. Even though no one's getting anywhere particularly fast, there's just an urgency in life in general, then that kind of raises it, makes it more of a high-octane atmosphere, and it increases the chances of collisions. And you probably say that's the same with cyclists as well. You know, when the cyclists are desperate to get to get from A to B quickly, and they jump traffic lights, or they weave in and out of cars undertake on the left when it is unsafe, then it just all up the chances of something going wrong.
Yeah, I think I'd agree on that one, because up here, I mean, in the Yorkshire Dales, on a nice day like today, or like we've had the last few weeks, there are hot spots where there's a lot of traffic and narrow roads. But in general, it's pretty quiet, and people are just generally moving around a bit slower. I guess if you were cycling around near Paris or in the cities of Belgium or Holland or whatever, the traffic would be a little bit more frenetic. But even then, I've experienced cycling in some of those cities, and it just does seem to be a little bit more geared up towards cyclists with the bike lanes and everything. But then let's just move on finally then to this other incident, which received a lot of social media postings and chatter, which was the horse on the course at the Windsor Triathlon.
Yeah, or as the horse rider might say, there was a race on her roads.
Yes,
it did get quite emotive, right? And yeah, probably saw the worst and the worst of social media because of it.
Mm.
So what was your take on it then, for anybody who has been living in a cave for the past couple of weeks and didn't
know
that there was an incident with a horse?
Okay, so the first I saw of it was, it looks like the horse rider is trotting along. She's maybe half a metre out from the curb on a nice sort of B road in and around Windsor Great Park there. And the Windsor Triathlon's taking place at the same time. Now, she looks like she's got a GoPro on her head or on her chest. And you can see the cyclist going past, and then the next thing you hear her shouting, a group of cyclists come past, including a couple that come past on the white line marking the inside of the road. Now, what I don't know is whether there'd been warnings about the race and she decided to ignore them and go on that road anyway because she rides on there all the time, or whether the road was still open to traffic and she had every right to be there and the cyclists were just riding head down and just didn't see her, or whether they did see her and just ignored decent human etiquette and decided that their race was more important. Maybe you know a bit more than me, Tim.
Well, I certainly don't know the horse rider's view, or whether she was aware that there was a race going on that morning. And even if she did, I imagine she didn't think she was going to get caught up in that kind of situation, because it was just essentially putting herself and her horse in jeopardy. So that would be the first thing. In terms of the riders themselves, again, it's difficult to know what was going through their mind. And they probably weren't, as I've just written a column actually for 220 on this, they were thinking about racing, and then they come across a horse, and then all of a sudden they have to flip their mindset, and maybe they weren't capable of doing that. And maybe we can all say that they should have been capable of doing that. But sat here chatting to you on the phone like this, it's dead easy for me to say that in a racing environment it's potentially slightly different. So I know one of the police are looking into it for the two that undercut the horse. The most dangerous part of it, and the worst of the video clip, as everyone can see, is when the one actually clips the horse. Now, the organizers, Human Race, said that one of them came forward and the other didn't. They've just released a statement on that. They've both been identified, and the one that didn't come forward, Human Race are banning for life. And then it's up to the police to see whether they will take any further action against those two cyclists, because obviously I think they're in breach of the highway code by undertaking the horse like that. But I think my take on it is, rather than kind of dishing out too many damning verdicts on all and sundry, we should maybe take a step back and kind of say, well, there but the grace of God, what would you have done, Simon, in that situation? What would I have done? We'd like to think we'd have done the right thing. We'd have slowed down massively. But would we? Honestly, I don't know.
Well, I suppose the first thing is, I've got a friend who was running around in Leeds through the woods near a riding school, and there were some horses there, and he tried to give one of the horses a wide berth, but it kicked out and it caught him on the leg and it shattered his femur. And I hesitate to think what would have happened if that horse had spun round and caught one of those cyclists, because it could have been so much worse. The second thing is that I remember doing, we talked about racing in Germany. I did Ironman Frankfurt in its first year, I think it was. And as you go, the swim takes place outside the city. You ride in about 15K and then you go through the city and out onto the other side. And you have to cross some tram lines. And a group of five or six cyclists went past me and something happened on the tram lines, I know not what, but there was the next thing is they were all on the floor, and one of the guys at the back wasn't moving. Now, I was a bit behind them, but I actually did, nobody else stopped for him. I actually stopped, and then another guy stopped, and he was still, you know, still conscious, but he was hurting, so we helped him to get his bike off the road and moved him over to the side. Now, I guess that cost me 5 or 10 minutes, but in that instance, my thought was, this is about a guy who's come off his bike and might be seriously injured. It's much more important than my race. I can't speak for what goes through other people's minds at that point, but I always think that's, personally, I always think that's far more important than any time I might get on doing an Ironman, you know, and what my finishing result might say. But not everybody thinks like me, I suppose.
Yeah, and also some people, it takes longer to process, so they may not think, they may think like that a few minutes later, and they go, oh, I should have stopped there, I should have slowed down there, I should have acted differently there.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, we don't see any build-up to actually what happens. We see the cyclist speeding past the horse, but we don't know whether it was coming round a corner, whether they happened upon it really quickly. And none of this makes it excusable what happened. But also, it was the Windsor Triathlon, which is an event that you get a lot of newcomers to the sport doing as well. So even if they did know the highway code, maybe they were just quite inexperienced. I'm just saying that there could be, you know, before we all just slam them with the judgment, then there could be plenty of other factors that play into it.
Yeah, I guess that just, well, like you said at the beginning of this little bit of the conversation, one, it shows the bad side of social media with everybody jumping to conclusions and voicing their opinion. Two, it shows the weakness of taking something out of context. You need to see the whole situation, don't you? Not just the small section that you actually do see. You need to know everything else that surrounded it before and afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. And but I think a couple of things, there could be some good that comes out of it, both Human Race and also British Triathlon Federation, who had actually said that they were going to speak to the horse running community anyway. But Human Race had put in their statement, they put in some measures to both improve communication, improve the briefing, find out some more learning, improve the signage, talk to local safety groups. So, and they're going to then disseminate that knowledge around the triathlon community. So things should improve from here on. Remember, Windsor Triathlon has been running for 28 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not incompetent in this at all. They've been putting on a great race and a much celebrated race. I think 7 times it's been the British Triathlon Race of the Year. So, you know, not everything is bad.
Well, as an example of how things can disseminate through the triathlon community, I was commentating at Holcombe for the Outlaw Half there a couple of weeks ago. The bike course passes by Sandringham, one of the Queen's residences, and they had a carriage riding competition that was taking place that weekend. But I know that in the briefing, we firstly made people aware that there was this carriage riding tournament. Secondly, Ian Hamilton, the race director and owner, had actually spoken to the organisers of this event, and they actually had priority from the local highways authority. The priority was given to the triathlon rather than the horse riding. So if the marshals ask the horse riders to stop because they're expecting a wave of cyclists to come past, then they had to do that. But both sets of competitors were briefed about the other event to make the horse riders aware that they'd be being passed by cyclists moving at high speed, and to let the cyclists know that there may be mobile obstacles on the road that they needed to take care of. So if that was one of the benefits of it, then that's good, I guess.
Yeah, it sounds like they did everything right, and it went off without incident, so it's a positive.
Perfect. Well, that's probably a good. We've had a few things, negative things, to chat about today, Tim. So I guess finishing on a positive is always a good thing. What are you up to next then? And what do you think will be the topic of our conversation in our next call in a month's time?
I'm not sure. As long as my groin area recovers, I'm actually off to do Dubrovnik. Which is the first triathlon that's taking place out there, and that's in the autumn time, so I should try and get myself in some sort of shape for that.
You should do. What's Dubrovnik? Is that Slovakia, Serbia, Croatia?
Croatia.
Well, that always a lovely part of the world to go to, even if you're not doing a triathlon.
Yeah, that's where I'm going.
Excellent. Triathlon tourism at its best then.
Absolutely. Well, so I'll bring you the full skinny back on that.
Well, while you're doing that, I am preparing. My next challenge is a channel swimming relay with a group of friends, including my partner Fiona, and we will be doing that one, weather permitting, and obviously permitting the other people who've booked the boat before us, how quickly they get across, probably the third week in August. So the water temper should be quite nice and toasty after this lovely warm weather we've been having.
Enjoy.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about that next time then. Your trip to Dubrovnik and my trip to Calais.
Absolutely, it'd be a pleasure.
All right, well, listeners, thank you very much for joining myself and Tim Hemming. Thank you, Tim, for joining us again. As always, it's been a pleasure having you on the show for a third time.
No problem.
Listeners, we do appreciate the fact that there's many other podcasts you can choose to listen to, so thanks for choosing ours. Hope you've enjoyed the conversation between me and Tim today. We'll be back very soon, but for now, have a great week. Bye-bye. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.